Leaf washed over him in a great warm wave. "Already, Will," said the rector genially, pulling on his overcoat. He went on, still preoccupied, to Paul. "Of course I do agree the double concerto is one of the best. I only wish he'd recorded the unaccompanied Bach suites. Heard him do them in a church in Edinburgh once at the festival. Marvellous." Paul, sharper-eyed, said, "Is anything wrong, Will?"
"No,"
Will said.
"That is... no."
He was trying desperately to think of some way of getting the two of them outside the church before he came near the door himself. Before whatever might happen did happen. By the church door he could see the old ones move slowly into a tight group, supporting one another. He could feel the force now, very strong, very close, all around. The air was thick with it. Outside the church was destruction and chaos, the heart of the dark, and he could think of nothing that he could do to turn it aside. Then, as the rector and Paul turned to walk through the nave, he saw both of them pause in the same instant, and their heads go up like the heads of wild deer on the alert. It was too late now. The voice of the dark was so loud that even humans could sense its power. Paul staggered as if someone had pushed him in the chest and grabbed a pew for support.
"What is that?" he said huskily. "Rector, what on earth is it?"
Mr. Beaumont had turned very white. There was a glistening of sweat on his forehead, though the church was very cold again now.
"Nothing on earth, I think." "Perhaps," he said. "God forgive me."
And he stumbled a few paces near the church door, like a man struggling through waves in the sea, and leaning forward slightly made a sweeping sign of the cross. He stammered out,
"Defend us, thy humble servants, in all assaults of our enemies, that we, surely trusting in thy defence, may not fear the power of any adversaries."
Farmer Dawson said very quietly but clearly from the group beside the door,
"No, Rector."
The rector seemed not to hear him. His eyes were wide, staring out at the snow. He stood transfixed. He shook like a man with fever. The sweat came running down his cheeks. He managed to half-raise one arm and point behind him.
"Vestry," he gasped out. "Book. On table. Exercise."
"Poor brave fellow," said John Smith in the old speech. "This battle is not for his fighting. He is bound to think so, of course, being in his church." "Be easy, Reverend," said his wife in English. Her voice was soft and gentle, strongly of the country.
The rector stared at her like a frightened animal, but by now all his powers of speech and movement had been taken away. Frank Dawson said,
"Come here, Will."
Pushing against the dark, Will came forward slowly. He touched Paul on the shoulder as he passed, looking into puzzled eyes in a face as twisted and helpless as the rector's, and said softly,
"Don't worry. It'll be all right soon."
Each of the old ones touched him gently as he came into the group, as if joining him to them, and Farmer Dawson took him by the shoulder. He said,
"We must do something to protect those two, Will, or their minds will bend. They cannot stand the pressure. The dark will send them mad. You have the power, and the rest of us do not."
It was Will's first intimation that he could do anything another old one could not, but there was no time for wonder. With the gift of gramarye, he closed off the minds of his brother and the rector behind a barrier that no power of any kind could break through. It was a perilous undertaking, since he, the Maker, was the only one who could remove the barrier. And if anything were to happen to him, the two protected ones would be left like vegetables, incapable of any communication, forever. But the risk had to be taken. There was nothing else to be done. Their eyes closed gently as if they had gone quietly to sleep. They stood very still. After a moment their eyes opened again, but were tranquil and empty, unaware.
"All right," said Farmer Dawson. "Now."
The old ones stood in the doorway of the church, their arms linked together. None spoke a word to another. Wild noise and turbulence rose outside. The light darkened, the wind howled and whined, the snow whirled in and whipped their faces with white chips of ice. And suddenly the rooks were in the snow, hundreds of them, black flurries of malevolence, cawing and croaking, diving down at the porch in shrieking attack and then swooping up away. They could not come close enough to claw and tear. It was as if an invisible wall made them fall back within inches of their targets. But that would be only for as long as the old one's strength could hold. In a wild storm of black and white, the dark attacked, beating at their minds as at their bodies, and above all, driving hard at the sign-seeker, Will. And Will knew that if he had been on his own, his mind, for all its gifts of protection, would have collapsed. It was the strength of the circle of the old ones that held him fast now. But for the second time in his life, even the circle could do no more than hold the power of the dark at bay. Even together, the old ones could not drive it back. And there was no lady now to bring aid of a greater kind. Will realized once more helplessly that to be an old one was to be very old before the proper time, for the fear he began to feel now was worse than the blind terror he had known in his attic bed, worse than the fear the dark had put into him in the great hall. This time his fear was adult, made of experience and imagination and care for others. And it was the worst of all. In the moment that he knew this, he knew too that he, Will, was the only means by which his own fear could be overcome, and thus the circle fortified and the dark driven away.
"Who are you?"
he asked himself, and answered, "You are the sign-seeker. You have three of the signs, half the circle of things of power. Use them." The sweat was standing on his own forehead now, as it had done on the rector's, though now the rector and Paul stood in smiling peace, oblivious outside everything that was going on. Will could see the strain on the faces of the others, Farmer Dawson most of all. Slowly he moved his hands inwards, bringing the hands each held closer to one another, John Smith's left hand nearer to Farmer Dawson's right. And when they were close enough, he joined his neighbour's hands, shutting himself out. For a panicking moment, he clutched them again as if he were tightening a knot. Then he let go and stood alone. Unprotected now by the circle, though sheltered behind it, he swayed under the impact of the raging ill will outside the church. Then, moving very deliberately, he unclasped his belt with its three precious burdens and draped it over his arm, took from his pocket the rook's feather, and wove it into the center sign, the bronze-quartered circle. Then he took the belt in both his hands, holding it up before him, and moved slowly round until he stood alone in the church porch, facing the howling, rook-screaming, icy dark beyond. He had never felt so lonely before. He did nothing. He thought nothing. He stood there and let the signs work for themselves. And suddenly, there was silence. The flapping birds were gone. No wind howled. The dreadful, mad humming that had filled the air and the mind was vanished altogether. Every nerve and muscle in Will's body went limp as the tension disappeared. Outside, the snow still quietly fell. But the flakes were smaller now. The old ones looked at one another and laughed.
"The full circle will do the real job," said old George. "But half a circle can do a lot, eh, young Will?"
Will looked down at the signs in his hand and shook his head in wonder. Farmer Dawson said softly,
"In all my days since the Grail disappeared, that's the first time I've seen anything but the mind of one of the great ones drive back the dark. Things, this time. They did it alone, for all our willing. We have things of power again. It has been a long, long time."
Will was still looking at the signs, staring as if they held his eyes for some purpose. "Wait,"
he said abstractedly. Don't move. Stay still for a moment. They paused, startled. The smith said, Is there trouble?
Look at the signs, Will said. Something's happening to them. They're glowing.
He turned slowly, still holding the belt with the three signs as before, until his body was blocking the grey light from the door, and his hands were in the gloom of the church. And the signs grew brighter and brighter, each of them glowing with a strange inward light. The old one stared.
Is it the power of driving back the dark?
Said John Smith's wife in her soft lilt.
Is it something in them that was sleeping and begins to wake now?
Will was trying vainly to sense what the signs were telling him.
I think it's a message. It means something. But I can't get through.
The light poured out of the three signs, filling their half of the dark little church with brilliance. It was a light like sunlight, warm and strong. Nervously, Will reached out a finger to touch the nearest circle, the sign of iron, but it was neither hot nor cold. Farmer Dawson said suddenly,
Look up there.
His arm was out, pointing up the nave towards the altar. In the instant they turned, they saw what he had seen. Another light, blazing from the wall, just as beside them the light blazed from the signs. It shone out like the beam from a great torch. And Will understood. He said happily,
So that's why.
He walked up towards the second patch of brilliance, carrying the belt and the signs so that the shadows on the pews and on the beams of the roof moved with him as he went. As the two lights grew closer and closer together, each seemed to grow brighter still. With Frank Dawson's tall, heavy form looming behind him, Will paused in the middle of the shaft of brilliance reaching out from the wall. It looked as if a slit window were letting light through from some unimaginably bright room beyond. He saw that the light was coming from something very small, as long as one of his fingers, lying on its side. He said with certainty to Mr. Dawson,
I must take it quickly, you know, while the light still shines from it. If the light is not shining, it can't be found at all.
And putting the belt with the sign of iron and the sign of bronze and the sign of wood into Frank Dawson's hands, he went forward to the light cleft wall and reached into the small source of the enchanted beam. The glowing thing came out of the wall easily from a break in the stucco where the Chiltern flints of the wall showed through. It lay on his palm, a circle, quarter by a cross. It had not been cut into that shape. Even through the light in it, Will could see the smooth roundness of the sides that told him this was a natural flint, grown in the Chiltern chalk 15 million years ago.
The sign of stone,
Farmer Dawson said. His voice was gentle and reverent, his dark eyes unreadable.
We have the fourth sign, Will.
Together they walked back to join the others, carrying the bright things of power. The three old ones watched in silence. Paul and the rector now sat tranquil in a pew as if sleeping. Will stood with his fellows and took the belt and threaded on the sign of stone to stand there next to the other three. He had to squint through half-closed eyes to keep the brightness from blinding him. Then, when the fourth sign was in position next to the rest, all the light in them died. They were dark and quiet as they had been before, and the sign of stone showed itself as a smooth and beautiful thing with the grey-white surface of an undamaged flint. The black rook's feather was still woven into the sign of bronze. Will took it out. He did not need it now. When the light went out of the signs, Paul and the rector stirred. They opened their eyes, startled to find themselves sitting in a pew when a moment ago, it seemed to them, they had been standing. Paul jumped up instinctively, his head turning, questioning.
It's gone, he said.
He looked at Will, and a peculiar expression of puzzlement and wonder and awe came over his face. His eyes travelled down to the belt in Will's hands.
What happened? He said.
The rector stood up, his smooth, plump face creased in an effort to make sense of the incomprehensible.
Certainly. It has gone, he said, looking slowly round the church. Whatever influence it was.
The Lord be praised. He too looked at the signs on Will's belt. He glanced up again, smiling suddenly, an almost childish smile of relief and delight. That did the work, didn't it? The cross. Not of the church, but a Christian cross, nonetheless.
Very old, them crosses are, Rector, said old George unexpectedly, firm and clear. Made a long time before Christianity. Long before Christ.
The rector beamed at him. But not before God, he said simply. The old ones looked at him. There was no answer that would not have offended him, so no one tried to give one. Except, after a moment, Will.
There's not really any before and after, is there? He said. Everything that matters is outside time, and comes from there and can go there.
Mr. Beaumont turned to him in surprise.
You mean infinity, of course, my boy.
Not altogether, said the old one that was Will. I mean the part of all of us, and of all the things we think and believe, that has nothing to do with yesterday or today or tomorrow, because it belongs at a different kind of level. Yesterday is still there, on that level. Tomorrow is there too. You can visit either of them. And all gods are there, and all the things they have ever stood for. And, he added sadly, the opposite too.
Will, said the rector, staring at him. I'm not sure whether you should be exorcised or ordained. You and I must have some long talks. Very soon.
Yes, we must,
Will said equably. He buckled on his belt, heavy with its precious burden. He was thinking hard and quickly as he did so, and the chief image before his mind was not Mr. Beaumont's disturbed theological assumptions, but Paul's face. He'd seen his brother looking at him with a kind of fearful remoteness that bit into him with the pain of a whiplash. It was more than he could stand. His two worlds must not meet so closely. He raised his head, gathering all his powers, spread straight the fingers of both hands, and pointed one hand at each of them.
You will forget, he said softly in the old speech. Forget. Forget.
In a church in Edinburgh once, marvellous,
the rector said to Paul, reaching to do up the top button of his overcoat.
The Saraband in the fifth suite literally had me in tears. He's the greatest cellist in the world, without a doubt.
Oh, yes, said Paul. Oh, yes, he is.
He hunched his shoulders inside his own coat.
Has Mum gone ahead, Will? Hey, Mr. Dawson, hello, happy Christmas.
And he beamed and nodded at the rest as they all turned towards the church porch and the scattered flakes of drifting snow.
Happy Christmas, Paul, Mr. Beaumont, said Farmer Dawson gravely. Nice service, sir, very nice. Ah, seasonal warmth, Frank, said the rector. Wonderful season, too. Nothing can interfere with our Christmas services, not even all this snow.
Laughing and chatting, they went out into the white world, where the snow lay mounded over the invisible tombstones and the white fields stretched down to the freezing Thames. There was no sound anywhere, no disturbance, only the occasional murmur of a car passing on the distant Bath Road. The rector turned aside to find his motorbike. The rest of them went on in a cheerful straggle to take their respective paths home. Two black rooks were perched on the lych gate as Will and Paul drew close. They rose into the air slowly, half-hopping, dark, incongruous shapes against the white snow. One of them passed close to Will's feet and dropped something there, giving a deprecatory croak as he passed. Will picked it up. It was a glossy horse chestnut from the Rook's Wood, as fresh as if it had ripened only yesterday. He and James always collected such nuts from the wood in early autumn for their school games of Conkers, but he had never seen one as large and round as this. "There now," said Paul, amused, "you have a friend, bringing you an extra Christmas present."
"A peace offering, perhaps," said Frank Dawson behind them, with no trace of expression in his deep Buckinghamshire voice. "And then again, perhaps not. Happy Christmas, lads. Enjoy your dinner."
And the old ones were gone, up the road.
Will stared at the conker. "Well, I never," he said. They closed the church gate, knocking a shower of snow from its flat iron bars. Round the corner came the coughing roars of a motorcycle as the rector tried to kick his steed into life. Then a few feet ahead of them, on the trampled snow, the rook flew down again. It walked backwards and forwards irresolutely and looked at Will.
"Cark,"
it said, very gently for a rook.
"Cark, cark, cark."
Then it walked a few paces forward to the churchyard fence, jumped down again into the churchyard, and walked back a few paces as before. The invitation could hardly have been more obvious.
"Cark,"
said the rook again, louder. The ears of an old one know that birds do not speak with the precision of words. Instead, they communicate emotion. There are many kinds and degrees of emotion, and there are many kinds of expression, even in the language of a bird. But although Will could tell that the rook was obviously asking him to come and look at something, he could not tell whether or not the bird was being used by the dark. He paused, thinking of what the rooks had done. Then he fingered the shiny brown chestnut in his hand. "All right, bird," he said. "One quick look." He went back through the gate, and the rook, croaking like an old swinging door, walked clumsily ahead of him up the church path and round the corner. Paul watched, grinning. Then he saw Will suddenly stiffen as he reached the corner, vanish for a moment, and then reappear.
"Paul, come quick, there's a man in the snow."
Paul called the rector, who had just begun pushing his cycle up the road, to start it there, and together they came running. Will was bending over a hunched figure lying in the angle between the church wall and the tower. There was no movement, and the snow had already covered the man's clothes, half an inch thick with its cold, feathery flakes. Mr. Beaumont moved Will gently aside and knelt, turning the man's head and feeling for a pulse.
"He's alive, thank God, but very cold. Pulse isn't very good. Must have been here long enough for most men to die of exposure. Look at the snow. Let's get him inside."
"In the church?"
"Well, of course."
"Let's take him to our house," Paul said impulsively. "It's only just round the corner, after all. It's warm and a lot better, at any rate until an ambulance or something can come."
"A wonderful idea," said Mr. Beaumont warmly. "Your good mother is a Samaritan, I know. Just until Dr. Armstrong can be called, we certainly can't leave the poor fellow here. Don't think there's a broken bone. Heart trouble, probably."
He tucked his heavy cycle gloves under the man's head to keep it from the snow, and Will saw the face for the first time. He said in alarm,
"It's the walker."
They turned to him.
"Who?"
"An old tramp who hangs around. Paul, we can't take him home. Can't we get him to Dr. Armstrong's surgery? In this?"
Paul waved a hand at the darkening sky. The snow was whirling round them thicker again, and the wind was higher.
"But we can't take him with us. Not the walker. He'll bring back the—"
He stopped suddenly, halfway through a yelp.
"Oh," he said helplessly, "of course you can't remember, can you?"
"Don't worry, Will. Your mother won't mind. A poor man in extremis."
Mr. Beaumont was bustling now. He and Paul carried the walker to the gate like a muffled heap of ancient clothes. He managed finally to start the motorcycle, and they propped the inert shape on it somehow. Then, half riding, half pushing, the strange little group made its way to the Stantons' house. Will glanced behind him once or twice, but the rook was nowhere to be seen.
"Well, well," said Max fastidiously as he came down into the dining room. "Now I've really met a dirty old man."
"He smelled," Barbara said.
"You're telling me. Dad and I gave him a bath. My Lord, you should have seen him. Well, no, you shouldn't. Put you off your Christmas dinner. Anyway, he's as clean as a newborn babe now. Dad even washed his hair and his beard. And Mum's burning his horrible old clothes, when she's made sure there's nothing valuable in them."
"Not much danger of that, I should think," said Gwen on her way in from the kitchen. "Here, move your arm. This dish is hot."
"We should lock up all the silver," said James.
"What silver?" said Mary witheringly.
"Well, Mum's jewellery, then, and the Christmas presents. Tramps always steal things."
"This one won't be stealing much for a time," said Mr. Stanton, coming to his place at the head of the table with a bottle of wine and a corkscrew. "He's ill, and fast asleep now, snoring like a camel."
"Have you ever heard a camel snore?" said Mary.
"Yes," said her father, "and ridden one, so there." "When's the doctor coming, Max?"
Pity to interrupt his dinner, poor man. We didn't, said Max. He's out delivering a baby, and they don't know when he'll be back. The woman was expecting twins.
Oh, Lord.
Well, the old boy must be all right if he's asleep. Just needs rest, I expect. I must say he seemed a bit delirious, all that weird talk coming out.
Gwen and Barbara brought in more dishes of vegetables. In the kitchen, their mother was making impressive clattering noises with the oven.
What weird talk? Said Will.
Goodness knows, said Robin. It was when we first took him up. Sounded like a language unknown to the human ear. Maybe he comes from Mars.
I only wish he did, Will said. Then we could send him back.
But a shout of approval had greeted his mother, beaming over the glossy brown turkey, and nobody heard him. They turned on the radio in the kitchen while they were doing the washing up. Heavy snow is falling again over the south and west of England, said the impersonal voice. The blizzard, which has been raging for 12 hours in the North Sea, is still immobilizing all shipping on the southeast coasts. The London docks closed down this morning due to power failures and transport difficulties caused by heavy snow and temperatures approaching zero. Snowdrifts blocking roads have isolated villages in many remote areas. And British Rail is fighting numerous electrical failures and minor derailments caused by the snow. A spokesman said this morning that the public is advised not to travel by rail except in cases of emergency. There was a sound of rustling paper. The voice went on. The freak storms which have intermittently raged over the south of England for the last few days are not expected to diminish until after the Christmas holiday, the Meteorological Office said this morning. Fuel shortages have worsened in the southeast, and householders have been asked not to use any form of electrical heating between the hours of 9 a.m. and midday or 3 and 6 p.m.
Poor old Max, Gwen said. No trains. Perhaps he can hitchhike. Listen, listen.
A spokesman for the Automobile Association said today that road travel was at present extremely inadvisable on all roads except major motorways. He added that motorists stranded in heavy snowstorms should, if possible, remain with their vehicles until the snow stops. Unless a driver is quite certain of his location and knows he can reach help within 10 minutes, the spokesman said he should on no account leave his car. The voice went on among exclamations and whistles, but Will turned away. He had heard enough. These storms could not be broken by the old ones without the power of the full circle of signs. And by sending the storms, the dark hoped to stop him from completing the circle. He was trapped. The dark was spreading its shadow not only over his quest, but over the ordinary world, too. From the moment the rider had invaded his cozy Christmas that morning, Will had watched the dangers grow. But he had not anticipated this wider threat. For days now, he had been too much caught up in his own perils to notice those of the outside world. But so many people were threatened now by the snow and cold. The very young, the very old, the weak, the ill. The walker won't have a doctor tonight, that's certain, he thought. It's a good job he isn't dying. The walker. Why was he here? There had to be some meaning behind it. Perhaps he had simply been hovering for his own reasons and been blasted by the attack of the dark on the church. But if so, why had the Rook, an agent of the dark, brought Will to save him from freezing to death? Who was the Walker, anyway? Why could all the powers of Grammarly tell him nothing about the old man at all? There were carols on the radio again. Will thought bitterly, "Happy Christmas, world." His father, passing, slapped him on the back. "Cheer up, Will. It's bound to stop tonight. You'll be tobogganing tomorrow. Come on, time to open the rest of the presents. If we keep Mary waiting any longer, she'll explode." Will went to join his cheerful, noisy family. Back in the cozy, brilliant cave of the long room with the fire and the glowing tree, it was untouched Christmas for a while, just as it had always been. And his mother and father and Max had joined to give him a new bicycle with racing handlebars and 11 gear speeds. Will was never quite sure whether what happened that night was a dream. In the darkest part of the night, the small chill hours that are the first of the next day, he woke, and Merriman was there. He stood towering beside the bed in a faint light that seemed to come from within his own form. His face was shadowed, inscrutable.
"Wake up, Will. Wake up.
There is a ceremony we must attend. In an instant Will was standing. He found that he was fully dressed, with the signs on their belt round his waist. He went with Merriman to the window. It was mounded to half its height with snow, and still the flakes were quietly falling. He said, suddenly desolate,
"Isn't there anything we can do to stop it? They're freezing half the country, Merriman. People will be dying."
Merriman shook his white-maned head slowly, heavily.
"The dark has its strongest power of all, rising between now and the 12th day. This is their preparing. Theirs is a cold strength. The winter feeds it. They mean to break the circle forever before it is too late for them. We shall all face a hard test soon, but not all things go according to their will. Much magic still flows untapped along the old ones' ways, and we may find more hope in a moment. Come."
The window ahead of them flew open outward, scattering all the snow. A faint luminous path like a broad ribbon lay ahead, stretching into the snow-flecked air. Looking down, Will could see through it, see the snow-mounded outlines of roofs and fences and trees below. Yet the path was substantial, too. In one stride, Merriman had reached it through the window and was sweeping away at great speed with an eerie gliding movement, vanishing into the night. Will leapt after him, and the strange path swept him, too, off through the night, with no feeling either of speed or cold. The night around him was black and thick. Nothing was to be seen except the glimmer of the old one's airy way. And then all at once they were in some bubble of time, hovering, tilted on the wind, as Will had learned from his eagle of the Book of Grammary.
"Watch," Merriman said, and his cloak swirled round Will as if in protection.
Will saw, in the dark sky, or in his own mind, a group of great trees, leafless, towering over a leafless hedge, wintry, but without snow. He heard a strange, thin music, a high piping accompanied by the small, constant thump of a drum, playing over and over again a single melancholy tune. And out of the deep dark and into the ghostly grove of trees, a procession came. It was a procession of boys, in clothes of some time long past, tunics and rough leggings. They had hair to their shoulders and bag-like caps of a shape he had never seen before. They were older than he, about 15, he guessed. They had the half-solemn expressions of players in a game of charades, mingling earnest purpose with a bubbling sense of fun. At the front came boys with sticks and bundles of birch twigs. At the back were the players of pipe and drum. Between these, six boys carried a kind of platform made of reeds and branches woven together, with a bunch of holly at each corner. It was like a stretcher, Will thought, except that they were holding it at shoulder height. He thought at first that it was no more than that, and empty. Then he saw that it supported something. Something very small. On a cushion of ivy leaves, in the centre of the woven bier, lay the body of a minute bird. A dusty brown bird, neat billed. It was a wren. Merriman's voice said softly over his head out of the darkness,
"It is the hunting of the wren, performed every year since men can remember at the solstice. But this is a particular year, and we may see more if all is well. Hope in your heart, Will, that we may see more."
And as the boys and their sad music moved on through the sky trees and yet did not seem to pass, Will saw with a catch in his breath that instead of the little bird, there was growing the dim shape of a different form on the bier. Merriman's hand clutched at his shoulder like a steel clamp, though the big man made no sound. Lying on the bed of ivy, between the four holly tufts, now was no longer a tiny bird, but a small, fine-boned woman, very old, delicate as a bird, robed in blue. The hands were folded on the chest, and on one finger glimmered a ring with a huge rose-coloured stone. In the same instant, Will saw the face, and knew that it was the lady. He cried out in pain,
"But you said she wasn't dead."
"No more she is," Merriman said.
The boys walked to their music. The bier with the silent form lying there came close, and then moved away, vanishing with the procession into the night. and the piping sad tune and the drum beats dwindled after it. But on the very edge of disappearance, the three boys who had been playing paused, put down their instruments, and turned to stand gazing without expression at Will. One of them said, "Will Stanton, beware the snow." The second said, "The lady will return, but the dark is rising." The third, in a quick sing-song tone, chanted something that Will recognized as soon as it began. "When the dark comes rising, six shall turn it back. Three from the circle, three from the track. Wood, bronze, iron, water, fire, stone. Five will return, and one go alone." But the boy did not end there, as Merriman had done. He went on. "Iron for the birthday, bronze carried long. Wood from the burning, stone out of song. Fire in the candle ring, water from the thaw. Six signs the circle, and the grail gone before." Then a great wind came up out of nowhere, and in a flurry of snowflakes and darkness, the boys were gone, whirled away. And Will, too, felt himself whirling backwards, back through time, back along the shining way of the old ones. The snow lashed at his face. The night was in his eyes, stinging. Out of the darkness he heard Merriman calling to him, urgently, but with a new hope and resonance in his deep voice.
"Danger rises with the snow, Will. Be wary of the snow. Follow the signs. Beware the snow."
And Will was back in his room, back in his bed, falling into sleep with the one ominous word ringing in his head like the chiming of the deepest church bell over the mounting snow. Beware. Beware.
Part 3. The Testing. The Coming of the Cold. The next day the snow still fell, all day. And the next day, too. "I do wish it would stop," said Mary unhappily, gazing at the blind white windows. "It's horrible the way it just goes on and on. I hate it."
"Don't be stupid," said James. "It's just a very long storm. No need to get hysterical."
"This is different. It's creepy."
"Rubbish. It's just a lot of snow."
"Nobody's ever seen so much snow before. Look how high it is.
You couldn't get out of the back door if we hadn't been clearing it since it started to fall. We're going to be buried, that's what. It's pushing at us. It's even broken a window in the kitchen. Did you know that?"
Will said sharply,
"What?"
"The little window at the back near the stove. Granny came down this morning and the kitchen was cold as ice, with snow and bits of glass all over that corner. The snow had pushed the window in, the weight of it."
Jane sighed loudly.
"Weight isn't pushing. The snow gets blown into a drift at that side of the house, that's all. I don't care what you say, it's horrible. As if the snow was trying to get in."
She sounded close to tears.
"Let's go and see if the old tramp's woken up yet," Will said.
It was time to stop Mary before she came too near the truth. How many other people in the country were being made as frightened as this by the snow? He thought fiercely of the dark and longed to know what to do. The walker had slept through the previous day, hardly stirring except for occasional meaningless mutterings, and once or twice a small hoarse shout. Will and Mary went up to his room now, carrying a tray with cereal and toast and milk and marmalade.
"Good morning,"
Will said loudly and brightly as they went in.
"Would you like some breakfast?"
The walker opened a slit of an eye and peered at them through his shaggy grey hair, longer and wilder than ever now that it was clean. Will held out the tray towards him.
"Fuck!"
the walker croaked. It was a noise like spitting. Mary said,
"Well."
"Do you want something else instead, then?"
said Will.
"Or are you just not hungry?"
"Honey,"
the walker said.
"Honey?"
"Honey and bread. Honey and bread. Honey and..."
"All right,"
Will said. They took the tray away.
"Doesn't even say please," Mary said. "He's a nasty old man. I'm not going near him anymore."
"Suit yourself," Will said. Left alone, he found the tail end of a jar of honey in the back of the larder, rather crystalline round the edges, and spread it lavishly on three hunks of bread. He took this with a glass of milk up to the walker, who sat up greedily in bed and wolfed the lot. When eating, he was not a pretty sight.
Good, he said.
He tried to wipe some honey off his beard and lick the back of his hand, peeping at Will.
Still snowing. Still coming down, is it?
What were you doing out in the snow?
Nothing,
the walker said sullenly.
Don't remember.
His eyes narrowed craftily, and he gestured at his forehead and said in a plaintive whine,
Hit my head.
Do you remember where we found you?
No.
Do you remember who I am? Very promptly he shook his head.
No.
Will said softly again, this time in the old speech, Do you remember who I am? The walker's shaggy face was expressionless. Will began to think that perhaps he really had lost his memory. He leaned over the bed to pick up the tray with its empty plate and glass, and suddenly the walker let out a shrill scream and flinched away from him, cowering down at the far side of the bed.
No! He screeched. No! Get away! Take them away!
Eyes wide and terrified, he was staring at Will in loathing. For a moment, Will was baffled. Then he realized that his sweater had lifted as he reached out his arm, and the walker had seen the four signs on his belt.
Take them away,
the old man howled.
They burn! Get them out!
So much for lost memory, Will thought. He heard concerned feet running up the stairs and went out of the room. Why should the walker be terrified by the great signs, when he had carried one of them himself for so long? His parents were grave. The news on the radio grew worse and worse as the cold gripped the country and one restriction followed another. In all records of temperature, Britain had never been so cold. Rivers that had never frozen before stood as solid ice, and every port on the entire coast was iced in. People could do little more than wait for the snow to stop, but still the snow fell. They led a restless, enclosed life. Like cavemen in winter, said Mr. Stanton, and went to bed early to save fires and fuel. New Year's Day came and went and was scarcely noticed. The walker lay in bed, fidgeting and muttering, and refused to eat anything but bread and milk, which by now was tinned milk, watered down. Mrs. Stanton said kindly that he was regaining his strength, poor man. Will kept away. He was growing increasingly desperate as the cold tightened and the snow floated down and down. He felt that if he did not get out of the house soon, he would find the dark had boxed him up forever. His mother gave him an escape in the end. She ran out of flour, sugar, and tinned milk. I know nobody's supposed to leave the house except in dire emergency, she said anxiously, but really this counts as one. We do need things to eat. It took the boys 2 hours to shovel away through the snow in their own garden to the road, where a kind of roofless tunnel, the width of one snowplough, had been kept clear. Mr. Stanton had announced that only he and Robin would go to the village, but throughout the 2 hours, Will, panting and digging, begged to be allowed to go too, and by the end his father's resistance was so much lowered that he agreed. They wore scarves over their ears, heavy gloves, and 3 sweaters each under their coats. They took a torch. It was mid-morning, but the snow was coming down as relentlessly as ever, and nobody knew when they might get home. From the steep-sided cutting in the one road of the village, tiny, uneven paths had been trodden and shoveled to the few shops and most of the central houses. They could see from the footprints that someone had brought horses out from Dawson's farm to help carve a way to the cottages of people like Miss Bell and Mrs. Horniman, who could never have managed it for themselves. In the village store, Mrs. Pettigrew's tiny dog was curled up in a twitching grey heap in one corner, looking limper and unhappier than ever. Mrs. Pettigrew's fat son, Fred, who helped run the store, had sprained his wrist by falling in the snow and had one arm in a sling, and Mrs. Pettigrew was in a state. She twittered and dithered with nervousness, she dropped things, she hunted in quite the wrong places for sugar and flour and found neither of them, and in the end she sat down suddenly in a chair like a puppet dropped from its strings and burst into tears.
"Oh," she sobbed, "I'm so sorry, Mr. Stanton, it's this terrible snow. I'm so frightened, I don't know. I have these dreams that we're cut off and nobody knows where we are."
"We already are cut off," said her son lugubriously. "Not a car's been through the village for a week. No supplies and everyone running out. There's no butter, Not even any tin milk, and the flour won't last long. There's only 5 bags after this one.
And nobody with any fuel, Mrs. Pettigrew sniffed. And the little Randall baby sick with a fever, and poor Mrs. Randall without a piece of coal, and goodness knows how many more.
The shop bell twanged as the door opened, and in the automatic village habit, everyone turned to see who had come in. A very tall man in a voluminous black overcoat, almost a cloak, was taking off his broad-brimmed hat to show a mop of white hair. Deep-shadowed eyes looked down at them over a fierce, hooked nose.
"Good afternoon," Merriman said.
"Hello,"
said Will, beaming, his world suddenly bright.
"Afternoon,"
said Mrs. Pettigrew and blew her nose hard. She said, muffled by the handkerchief,
"Mr. Stanton, do you know Mr. Lyon? He's at the manor."
"How do you do?" said Will's father. "Butler to Miss Graythorne," Merriman said, inclining his head respectfully, "until Mr. Bates comes back from holiday. That is to say, when the snow stops. At present, of course, I can't get out, and Bates can't get in."
"It'll never stop,"
Mrs. Pettigrew wailed, and she burst into tears again.
"Oh, Mum," said Fat Fred in disgust. "I have some news for you, Mrs. Pettigrew," said Merriman in loud, soothing tones. "We have heard an announcement over the local radio, our telephone being dead, of course, like yours. There's to be a fuel and food drop in the manor grounds, as the place most easily visible from the air in this snow. And Miss Graythorne is asking if everyone in the village would not like to move into the manor for the emergency. It will be crowded, of course, but warm and comforting, perhaps. And Dr. Armstrong will be there. He is already on his way, I believe."
"That's ambitious," Mr. Stanton said reflectively.
"Almost futile, you might say."
Merriman's eyes narrowed slightly.
"But with no such intention."
"Oh, no, I do see that." Mrs. Pettigrew's tears ceased.
"Oh, what a lovely idea, Mr. Lyon. Oh, dear, it would be such a relief to be with other people, especially at night."
"I'm other people," said Fred.
"Yes, dear, but..."
Fred said stolidly,
"I'll go and get some blankets and pack some stuff from the shop."
"That would be wise," Merriman said. "The radio says the storm will grow very much worse this evening, so the sooner everyone can gather, the better." "Would you like some help with telling people?" Robin began pulling up his collar again.
"Excellent. That would be excellent."
"We'll all help," said Mr. Stanton. Will had turned to look out of the window at the mention of the storm, but the snow floating down out of the solid grey sky seemed much as before. The windows were so misted that it was difficult to see out of them at all, but he caught a glimpse now of something moving outside. There was someone out there on the snow road carved through Huntercombe Lane. He saw clearly only for a second as the figure passed the end of the Pettigrew's path, but a second was all he needed to recognize the man sitting erect on the great black horse.
"The rider has passed," he said quickly and clearly in the old speech.
Merriman's head jerked round. Then he collected himself and ostentatiously swept his hat onto his head.
"I shall be very grateful to have assistance."
"What did you say, Will?" Robin, distracted, was staring at his brother.
"Oh, nothing."
Will went to the door, making a great fuss over buttoning his coat.
"Just thought I saw someone."
"But you said something in some funny language."
"Of course I didn't. I just said, 'Who's that out there?' Only it wasn't anyone anyway."
Robin was still staring at him. "You sounded just like that old tramp when he was babbling when we first put him to bed." But he was not given to wasting time on surmise. He shook his practical head and dropped the subject. "Oh, well." Merriman managed to walk closely behind Will as they were leaving the Pettigrews to scatter and warn the rest of the villagers. He said softly in the old speech,
"Get the walker to the manor if you can, quickly, or he will stop you from getting out yourself, but you may have a little trouble with your father's pride."
By the time the Stantons reached home, after their struggling tour of the village, Will had almost forgotten what Merriman had said about his father. He was too busy working out how they could get the walker to the manor without actually having to carry him. He remembered only when he heard Mr. Stanton talking in the kitchen as they pulled off their coats and delivered their supplies. "Good of the old girl, having everyone in there. Of course they've got the space and the fires, and those old walls are so thick they keep the cold out better than anyone's. Much the best thing for the people from the cottages. Poor Miss Bell wouldn't have lasted long. Still, of course, we're all right here, self-contained. No point in adding to the manorial load.
Oh, Dad, Will said impulsively, don't you think we ought to go too?
I don't think so, said his father, with the lazy assurance that Will should have known was harder to break than any fervour.
But Mr. Lyon said it would be much more dangerous later on because of the storm getting worse.
I think I can make my own judgment of the weather, Will, without help from Miss Greythorne's butler, said Mr. Stanton amiably.
Oh, wow, said Max with cheerful rudeness. You rotten old snob, hark at you.
Come on, that's not what I meant. His father threw a wet scarf at him. Inverted snobbery, more like. I simply don't see any good reason for our trooping off to partake of the bounty of the Lady of the Manor. We're perfectly all right here.
Quite right, Mrs. Stanton said briskly. Now out of the kitchen, all of you. I want to make some bread.
The only hope, Will decided, was the walker himself. He slipped away and went upstairs to the tiny spare room where the walker lay in bed.
I want to talk to you.
The old man turned his head on the pillow.
All right,
he said. He seemed muted and unhappy. Suddenly, Will felt sorry for him.
Are you better? He said. I mean, are you actually ill now, or do you just feel weak?
I'm not ill,
the walker said listlessly.
No more than usual.
Can you walk?
You want to throw me out in the snow, is that it?
Of course not, Will said. Mum would never let you go off in this weather, and nor would I, not that I've got much say in it. I'm the very youngest in this family, you know that.
You are an old one,
the walker said, looking at him with dislike.
Well, that's different.
It's not different at all. This means there's no point talking about yourself to me as if you were just a little kid in a family. I know better.
Will said, you were guardian of one of the great signs. I don't see why you should seem to hate us.
I did what I was made to do, the old man said. You took me. You picked me out.
His brows creased as though he were trying to remember something from a long time ago. Then he grew vague again.
I was made to.
Well, look, I don't want to make you do anything, but there's one thing we all have to do. The snow's getting so bad that everyone in the village is going to live at the manor like a kind of hostel because it'll be safer and warmer.
He felt as he talked that the walker might know what he was going to say already, but it was impossible to get inside the old man's mind. Whenever he tried, he found himself floundering as if he had broken into the stuffing of a cushion.
The doctor will be there too, he said. So if you were to let everyone feel you needed to be somewhere with a doctor, we could all go to the manor.
You mean you aren't going otherwise?
The walker squinted suspiciously at him.
My father won't let us, but we have to. It's safer.
I won't go either,
the walker said. He turned his head away.
Go away. Leave me be.
Will said softly, warningly, in the old speech.
The dark will come for you. There was a pause.
Then very slowly the walker turned his shaggy grey head back again, and Will flinched in horror as he saw the face. For just a moment, its history was naked upon it. There were bottomless depths of pain and terror in the eyes. The lines of black experience were carved clear and terrible. This man had known somewhere such a fearful dread and anguish that nothing could really ever touch him again. His eyes were wide for the first time, stretched open with his knowledge of horror looking out. The walker said emptily,
"The dark has already come for me."
Will took a deep breath.
"But now the circle of the light comes," he said.
He pulled off the belt with the signs and held it before the walker. The old man flinched away, screwing up his face, whimpering like a frightened animal. Will felt sickened, but there was no help for it. He brought the signs closer and closer to the twisted old face until, like a piece of breaking wire, the walker's self-control snapped. He shrieked and began to babble and thrash about, screaming for help. Will ran outside and called for his father, and half the family came running.
"I think he's having some sort of fit,
Awful. Shouldn't we get him to Dr. Armstrong at the manor, Dad?
Mr. Stanton said doubtfully. We could get the doctor to come here, perhaps.
But he might very well be better off there, said Mrs. Stanton, staring at the walker in concern. The old man, I mean, with the doctor able to watch him, and more comfort and food. Really, this is alarming, Roger. I don't know what to do for him here.
Will's father gave in. They left the walker still tossing and raving with Max nearby in case of accidents, and went to turn the big family toboggan into a mobile stretcher. Only one thing nagged in Will's mind. It had to be his imagining. But in the moment when the walker had cracked at the sight of the great signs and become a mad old man once more, he had thought he saw a flash of triumph in the flickering eyes. The sky hung grey and heavy, waiting to snow as they left for the manor with the walker. Mr. Stanton took the twins with him and Will. His wife watched them go with unfamiliar nervousness.
I hope it really is over. Do you really think Will should go?
It comes in handy to have someone light sometimes in this snow, said his father over Will's splutter. He'll be all right.
You aren't going to stay there, are you?
Of course not. The only point of the exercise is to deliver the old man to the doctor. Come on, Alice, this isn't like you. There's no danger, you know.
I suppose not, Mrs. Stanton said.
They set off heaving the toboggan, with the walker strapped to it so trussed in blankets that he was invisible, a thick human sausage. Will left last. Gwen handed him the torches and the flask.
I must say I'm not sorry to see your discovery go, she said. He frightens me. More like an animal than an old man.
It seemed a long while before they reached the manor gates. The drive had been cleared and trodden down by many feet, and two bright pressure lamps hung by the great door, lighting the front of the house. Snow was falling again, and the wind beginning to blow chill round their faces. Before Robin's outstretched hand reached the doorbell, Merriman was opening the door. He looked first for Will, though no one else noticed the urgent flicker of his eyes.
Welcome, he said.
Evening, Roger Stanton said. Shan't stay, we're fine at the house, but there's an old chap here who's ill and he needs a doctor. All things considered, it seemed better to bring him here rather than have Dr. Armstrong going to and fro, so we hopped out before the storm broke.
It is rising already,
Merriman said, gazing out.
Then he stooped and helped the twins carry the walker's motionless, swaddled form into the house. At the threshold, the bundle of blankets jerked convulsively, and the walker could be heard muffled through his covers, shouting,
No, no, no!
The doctor, please, said Merriman to a woman standing nearby, and she scurried away. The great empty hall where they had sung their carols was filled with people now, warm and bustling, unrecognizable. Dr. Armstrong appeared, nodding briskly all round. He was a small, bustling man with a monkish fringe of grey hair circling his bald head. The Stantons, like all Huntercombe, knew him well. He had cured every ailment in the family for more years than Will had been alive. He peered at the walker, now twisting and moaning in protest.
"What's this, eh?"
"Shock, perhaps," said Merriman.
"He really behaves very oddly," Mr. Stanton said. "He was found unconscious in the snow some days ago, and we thought he was recovering. But now..."
The big front door slammed itself shut in the rising wind, and the walker screamed. Said the doctor, and beckoned two large young helpers to carry him off to some inner room.
Leave him to me, he said cheerfully. So far we've got one broken leg and two sprained ankles. He'll provide variety.
He trotted off after his patient. Will's father turned to peer out of a darkening window. My wife will start worrying, he said. We must go. Merriman said gently,
If you go now, I think you will leave, but not arrive. Probably in a little while.
The dark is rising, you see, Will said.
His father looked at him with a half smile.
You're very poetic all of a sudden. All right, we'll wait just a bit. I could do with a breather, to tell the truth.
Better say hello to Miss Greythorne in the meantime. Where is she, Lion?
Merriman, the deferential butler, led the way into the crowd.
It was the oddest gathering Will had ever seen. Suddenly half the village was living in close intimacy, a tiny colony of beds and suitcases and blankets. People hailed them from small nests scattered all round the huge room, a bed or a mattress tucked into a corner or fenced in by a chair or two. Miss Bell waved gaily from a sofa. It was like an untidy hotel with everyone camping in the foyer. Miss Greythorne was sitting stiff and upright in her wheelchair beside the fire.